Hi, I'm Derek Jensen. This is Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network. My guest today is George Werthner. He's a former Ecological Projects Director for the Foundation for Deep Ecology. He's an ecologist and wildlands activist. He's published 38 books on environmental issues and natural history, including such environmentally focused books as Welfare Ranching, Wildfire, Thrillcraft, Energy, and most recently Protecting the Wild. Today we talk about the assault on public lands. So, as always, thank you for your extraordinary work and thank you for being on the program.
I appreciate it and glad to be here.
So, when you say assault on public lands, what does that mean? And then also, can you give a history of, I don't want to say the history of public lands, because of course that is beyond just the formation of the BLM, et cetera. But can you talk about the formation of the BLM, the Forest Service, the Park Service, the National Monument System, whatever is appropriate to this discussion?
Sure. Well, briefly, the assault on public lands is attempts by mostly extractive interests, oil and gas, ranching, logging, etc., to have greater influence over the management of those lands to benefit their bottom line, basically. And this is not a new issue. It's almost been endemic to the creation of public lands in the first place. So I'll give you a little bit of history on that. It's kind of an interesting thing to think about, because our nation back in the mid-1800s was pretty much devoted to trying to give away as much land as possible. They had the Homestead Act, they had the Timber and Stone Act, they had the Mining Law of 1872. They gave almost 200 million acres to the railroads, presumably in for building, helping to finance the building of railroads across the country. In other words, the whole way of approach was to try to get rid of the public domain as quickly as possible. And part of the reason was it was a way to settle the country, which was seen as a way to make sure that we had people in various places to keep have a claim to the territory, you might say. And then the other was the hope to, get new tax revenues and so forth from all these endeavors. So that was the general policy, and the first sort of crack in that policy happened in 1864 during the Civil War. The federal government relayed the Yosemite Valley to the state of California to maintain as a state park, and the that was sort of the first time in a federal way that there was any attempt to keep lands from being given away. And then in 1872, an even more extraordinary thing happened. That was the designation of Yellowstone National Park. And you really have to look at this within the context of the era, where the whole goal was to give away land as quickly as possible and turn it into private land. So the idea of withdrawing from public acquisition and exploitation over 2 million acres of land in the headwaters of the Yellowstone River was a real change in whole attitudes about land and what the public policy should be. And that continued on through the 1880s and 90s. In the 1890s, legislation was passed that allowed the president to designate what were called at the time forest reserves. And the forest reserves are predecessors of our national forests. And the idea was to withdraw them primarily from homesteading, and other activities were still eventually going to be allowed on them, although initially they were more like national, what we think of as national parks, where logging was not allowed, etc., even though they were called forest reserves. And the main justification for these forest reserves was, in the West, aridity is a major issue, and the reserves were seen as a way to protect watersheds. And so then in 1890, we got our second and third national parks, which was Yosemite, much larger than the Yosemite Valley was protected in Yosemite National Park, and then the Sequoia National Park was also set aside. And a lot of that was due to the efforts of John Muir, who founded the Sierra Club. And then we get into sort of the late 1890s and early 1900s, and there was an increasing realization that maybe the frontier was ending. You know, I mean, the whole idea of giving away land was predicated on the idea that we have infinite land and we've got to settle it and use it and so forth. And that idea that the frontier was you know, sort of more limited started to give rise to efforts to take some of that land and keep it in federal ownership. And another thing that contributes to this that people should know about is when states west of the Mississippi River, primarily the western states, entered the Union, they would get a certain percentage of federal lands designated to them for their state use to fund schools and other activities. So that's a large part how we've gotten state forests and state rangelands in the West on state lands. In any event, so we're around 1900, and there have been a couple things that happened. One, and it pertains to this whole idea of national monuments, which I'll get to in a moment. But there was a stone dish found in Sequoia National Park by one of the employees there. And when the supervisor of the park demanded that that be kept in public ownership and be returned to the park, this worker refused. And there was actually no way that the superintendent could force him to give up this stone bowl. And that kind of led to some concern about all these antiquities, as they were called, mostly Indian ruins in places like Utah and Arizona and New Mexico, that increasingly were getting robbed by pot hunters and others. And so all of this was coming together, this sort of change in attitude about public lands, happened to coincide with the election of Teddy Roosevelt. Teddy Roosevelt was very conservation-oriented, especially I don't think there's been any president who's been as more conservation-oriented as Roosevelt. And though he was sort of a big game hunter, he was also an extremely astute bird watcher and very much believed in preserving wildlife and the habitat it relied on for future generations. So he's there, and Congress, to deal with this stone problem in Sequoia, passed what was called the Antiquities Act. And the basic idea behind the Antiquities Act, this was 1906, was to allow a president to designate certain features of public domain as national monuments. And the original purpose of it was to try to protect some of the Indian ruins around the West and those sort of artifacts. But it was also quickly used to protect other things. For example, Devil's Tower in Wyoming was designated a national monument for its geological features. And all along around this time, there's been discussion about setting aside the Grand Canyon as a national park. And Teddy Roosevelt was very much in favor of this. But there was, as is typical and still occurs, local opposition to creating the national park there. Miners, loggers, graziers, et cetera, in northern Arizona did want a park and fought against this idea. And then Roosevelt was sort of, I guess, reviewing the Antiquities Act and noticed that there was no size limit imposed other than large enough to protect whatever the object of protection in that monument was to occur. So Roosevelt checked with his attorney general and said, is there any limitation on the size of a national monument? And the attorney general reviewed the law and said, well, no, there isn't. And so the Teddy Roosevelt then said, well, I hereby declare that the Grand Canyon be set aside as a national monument, which greatly outraged the local people along the same lines as we hear today from people in southern Utah where the Bear Ears National Monument and other national monuments that have recently been designated. And it's important to note at this point that a lot of what are national parks today were originally national monuments. The difference between a national monument and a national park often is only a matter of how it was created. National parks can only be created by Congress. In other words, you have to get a bill through Congress that designates such and such a place as a national park, national seashore, or whatever. And a lot of these national monuments, like the Grand Canyon, eventually were redesignated by Congress as national parks. And the advantage of designation by Congress as a national park is that it's less subject to the whims of presidents. Like right now, President Trump is attempting to review, he says, 27 national monuments that have been designated by Bill Clinton, George Bush, and President Obama. And the review is supposed to determine whether they should even exist in the first place or should they be resized. Resized means made smaller or modified in other ways. And no president has done this since like the early 1900s, made any changes to national monuments created by other presidents. So this is a real first in having this review. And many of the areas that are being reviewed, I would not be surprised if in 10 or 15 or 20 years they were to be redesignated as national parks in keeping with some of the many other areas that were originally national monuments. For example, what is now Olympic National Park was a national monument. What is now Grand Teton National Park was a national monument. What is now Zion National Park was a national monument. What is Death Valley National Park was a national monument, and so on. So a lot of our very famous parks around the West originally had their origins as national monuments. So that's kind of how we got national monuments. Now, through the 1920s and 30s and so forth, we had a whole lot of national forests created, particularly, again, by Teddy Roosevelt. In fact, there's stories told about Teddy Roosevelt drawing on the floor of the White House with Gifford Pinchot, who was the first director of the Forest Service, say on the floor, a map of the West, drawing lines on it for new national forests. And as he was designating these new national forests, Western congressmen were very upset. You can read all this rhetoric about lockup of the land, the same kind of rhetoric we hear today, back in the early 1900s. And in fact, Congress passed a law making it illegal for Teddy Roosevelt to create any more national forests. So, and he didn't have enough votes to oppose, to veto it. In other words, if he vetoed it, it would be overridden. So the night before the law was to be taken, to take effect, he and Pinchot spent another night drawing lines on a map, and he created 16 more national forests that night before the law passed, making it illegal for him to make any new ones. So Teddy Roosevelt was quite a hero in a lot of ways. He also designated a lot of national wildlife refuges, too, by the way. So the Forest Service got its start about then during the Roosevelt era, and Gifford Pinchot was the first director. And national forests were seen different from national parks in that resource extraction could occur. So you could graze on national forests, you could log on national forests, you could mine on national forests. Most of those activities are prohibited in national parks. So that was sort of the origin of our Forest Service lands. And then in the 1930s, there was a whole lot of land that was designated as national forests. There was lands that were designated as national parks and wildlife refuges. And then there was a whole bunch of other sort of public domain that didn't have any special designation, and it was under the General Land Office and the Grazing Board. And in the 1940s, those two agencies were combined to create the Bureau of Land Management. And so that's how we got BLM lands. which were the lands, as it's sometimes said, the lands that nobody else wanted. In other words, if it had been good for homesteading, it would have been homesteaded. If it was good for mining, it would have been mined and so forth and privatized. And so we have a lot of lands around the West. In fact, more acreage in BLM lands than we have in under any of the other agencies, the Forest Service or the Park Service. And many of these national monuments that were established by Obama, as well as by Clinton, were on BLM lands primarily. So, for example, Grand Staircase Escalante in southern Utah was BLM. The Bears Ear National Monument just designated by Obama was BLM. The Mojave Trails in California, designated by Obama, was primarily BLM. So these agencies are still given the opportunity to manage them, presumably better than they would be just any old public land, which critics would say hasn't really happened. But that's the goal in any event. So what we have left is we have about a third of the nation's land, total land area, that's in public federal domain. And that's under all these four different agencies, Forest Service, Fish and Wildlife Service, which is the Wildlife Refuges, BLM, Bureau of Land Management, and the Forest Service. And collectively, you could say that's part of the nation's heritage for future generations. And it's also some of the most critical wildlife habitat we have left. It's some of the most important watershed drainages in the West. It is some of the most stunning scenic landscapes, and of course very important to a lot of people for just recreation and sort of communing, you might say, with nature. So it's a tremendous asset for the country. You go back east to places like New Jersey or Kentucky or wherever, and you have a lot less public domain in those places. And that's primarily because what is national forest lands or parks in those areas pretty much all had to be bought at one time or another and actually taken back from private ownership, whereas the public domain in the West has been retained in public ownership through all this. And depending on what it is, different activities are either prohibited or allowed, as I said. So you can mine on BLM land, you can log on BLM land and Forest Service land, but you can't on national forests. You can sometimes log, mine, etc. on wildlife refuges, but a lot less than you would on, say, just Forest Service or BLM land. And throughout this history of public domain, starting from way back in the 1800s, all the way to the current situation, there has been people, particularly in rural communities, who have always chafed under the idea that government, federal ownership of this land, and had certain regulations and prohibitions that limit their ability to utilize it and exploit it, primarily for their own profit. And so we have recently had examples, the Bundy boys who took over Mount Hood Wildlife Refuge, Clive and Bundy down in Nevada, who has been grazing his cows on public land for decades now without paying any fees and ignoring all warnings to remove his cows. Those are examples of people who basically feel that the federal government and the rest of us have no right to manage these lands, to have an opinion about how they're utilized, and basically shouldn't be allowed to control these lands. So that's where we got to today with the idea of privatization. And the fear is, and what is being done by some members of Congress is to introduce legislation, and there's various pieces of legislation out there that are ultimately designed to, in my view, and a lot of people's view, privatize these lands. They would never say that. That would never be the stated goal. But what will happen more than likely is that the lands would be sold off. So, for example, there are bills in Congress to turn over some federal lands to states. And why is that a worry? Well, a lot of states have no protections about selling off public domain. You can actually nominate lands for sale in states like Wyoming and Idaho. You can say, hey, I see 160 acres there. I want to nominate it for sale. And the state will put it up for a bid. And if you're the only bidder in particular, you can get it whatever price you want to offer for it. And so the goal of a lot of states is still like the frontier days, which is to sell off as much of the public domain as they can. This is an issue, for example, in Oregon right now. There's a state forest called Elliott State Forest. It's about 90,000 acres of land on the coast of Oregon. And the state initially, about a year ago or less, voted to sell off the entire state forest to the highest bidder. Well, they only got one bidder, and some people felt like it wasn't high enough. And there was a big movement also in Oregon to keep it in state ownership, public ownership. And just recently, I think last week, the state forestry board reversed its decision. I think that's who was in charge. Anyway, it was reversed, and now it's going to stay in public ownership. There's some plans about how they're going to accomplish that. But the point being is that transferring federal land to the states is very risky, and there's a good chance that a lot of that land would eventually be sold off to the highest bidder.
And so when we are talking about the Western resistance to public lands or Western assault on public lands, you said that there was opposition to the creation of these parks in the first place. And I want to read a few quotes from your excellent article called "Some People Have Always Hated National Monuments Until They Love Them." And the quotes are, there's three or four of them. When they made Yellowstone National Park, the editors of Montana's Helena Gazette said, "We regard the passage of the act to protect the area as a great blow struck at the prosperity of the towns of Bozeman and Virginia City," which of course could be said today too. It's the same. They use the exact same words. National Park, Grand Canyon National Park, the Williams Sun newspaper, Northern Arizona, captured the common sentiment of the time when it editorialized that the national park idea represented a, quote, fiendish and diabolical scheme, and that whoever had come up with such an idea must have been, quote, suckled by a sow and raised by an idiot. The fate of Arizona depends exclusively upon the development of our mineral resources. The Mount Olympus National Monument / Olympic National Park, a local person, 1909, wrote, "We would be fools to let a lot of foolish sentimentalists tie up the resources of the Olympic Peninsula in order to preserve its scenery." Jackson Hole, they said that Jackson would become a ghost town, which of course is nonsense. Glacier National Park, they argued that they should dismantle the park, arguing that it's more important to furnish homes to land-hungry people than to lock up the land as a rich man's playground, which no one will use or ever use. And I don't know exactly how the politics are where you live, George, but these sentences could happen today in Del Norte County in Northern California. And I've seen these essential quotes in the newspaper from locals arguing against the national park here.
Well, exactly. And that's the point I was trying to make, is that the rhetoric hasn't changed at all. They still use terms like lockup or that it's going to destroy the economy. And of course, time has shown in every instance that is exactly the opposite of what happens. As you refer to Jackson Hole, the ghost town, you know, has 16,000 people living in it today, and primarily living off of the national park that's just outside the town. The same with towns like Bozeman, which the Helena paper predicted was going to suffer tremendously. The experience is Bozeman is one of the most vigorous, economically vigorous towns in Montana, in the large part because of its proximity to Yellowstone. And it's very important for people to understand that. And one of the common criticisms you hear is that, you know, creating a park just makes seasonal jobs for part-time help. And that critique is totally wrong, because what happens, first of all, you get a lot of creation of small-scale businesses. You know, you can say whatever you want for it, but, you know, restaurants and bookstores and other things that, outdoor shops, fly fishing guides, whatever, these businesses are often run by local people who adapt to the creation of the park and then, you know, offer some sort of service or business that is attracted by that public domain there. But beyond that, there is a movement, and it's always been there, but it's really accelerated in the last decade or two, where people are choosing to live in places with what's perceived to be a high quality of life. And high quality, you know, is defined by a lot of things, lack of traffic, perhaps, you know, good schools, et cetera. But one of the factors is just having beautiful landscapes nearby with wildlife, with opportunities to go for a hike and otherwise recreate on. And that things like national parks and national monuments, one of the reasons they're attractive to people is that somebody who decides to live close by knows that those areas are likely to be retained and available, you know, throughout their lives for future generations. And so it makes it an attractive place for people to move businesses to. In other words, somebody who has nothing to do with a park. When I lived near Yellowstone, I lived adjacent to Yellowstone, in Livingston, Montana for about 12 years. And there were people moving to Livingston throughout the time I was there who had businesses either that they established in town or they brought with them. An example was a financial advisor I knew in town moved from Minneapolis to Livingston, and all his clients were back in Minneapolis, but he could do his work on a computer, and he moved to Livingston because he wanted to be close to Yellowstone Park. So he was spending his money locally. He, you know, was supporting the schools with his taxes. He eventually expanded his business and hired a few other people. And that's the kind of situation that's much more common today. So that, you know, his business, financial advising, has nothing to do with serving tourists, but it's still an economic opportunity that is in a large part being created and because of the proximity to Yellowstone Park. So we see that kind of thing happening in a lot of rural communities around the West. And the irony is, to me, is that a lot of these rural communities are very hostile to the idea of these changes, in part because, you know, my daddy was a logger, and by gosh, I'm going to be a logger, or my daddy was a rancher, and my grandfather was a rancher, and I'm going to be a rancher. And there's resistance to changing trying to see if you can do something different. And the other part of it that hurts a lot of these rural towns initially to get to a certain threshold of change is that the cultural attitudes in a lot of those towns are so negative that, you know, people that might be willing to bring a business to the community and liven up the economic opportunities are not willing to live there. So they hurt their own sort of hopes for the future in a lot of cases. And I'll give you an example. Burns, Oregon, where the Bundy guys took over Mount Hood Wildlife Refuge, is a case in point. Something like 35 or 40% of the people in Burns supported that takeover of the refuge. They didn't, they'll say, well, they didn't think they should be dealing with guns and stuff, but they really agreed with the general attitude that that the public lands around there should be turned over to the people of Burns to do what they want with it. Well, that attitude is really unattractive to somebody like me and a whole lot of other people who might be willing to otherwise find Burns an attractive location but it does have a lot of amenities, like wildlife refuge out the door, not to mention other public lands. So in their sort of negativity, they actually hinder the opportunity for different economic diversity in their communities. I'll give you another personal example. Years ago, I bought a lot in Challis, Idaho. I worked for the Forest Service on the Challis National Forest, and I bought a lot there. And I had always thought I would want to retire to Challis because it's just surrounded by a tremendous array of public land. There are wolves there. There's salmon in the Salmon River. And it's just a great outdoor location with a lot of wildlands close by. But as I got older, I realized that I just wouldn't fit in Challis. I mean, the community and is very hostile in general to public lands. They're hostile to wolves. It's just a place that I said to myself, you know, I just can't see myself living there. And eventually I sold my lot for that reason and never did settle in Challis. So what happens, I think, is this hostility to public lands actually hurts these communities. Tom Power, who I had as a professor in college, he used to be the chair of the economics department at the University of Montana. He used to say that most communities have what he called a rear-view mirror of their economy. And what he was meant is that people know what used to drive their economy. Oh, we used to be a logging town, or we used to be a mining town, or we used to be a ranching town. And he said, and most people have no idea what their economy is doing at this moment, much less can predict the future. And a lot of these small communities are constantly looking backwards, saying, you know, well, we used to be a logging community, and we should be a logging community. I mean, that's what's driving a lot of the voters who voted for Trump. You know, we're a coal mining town. We should be a coal mining town today, you know. Doesn't matter that coal mining, you know, coal burning coal contributes to global warming. We're going to be a coal mining town. And that kind of looking backwards instead of looking forward hurts these communities because they really are not willing to embrace what could be great opportunities.
So you're raising a whole bunch of really good points. And one of the ones that I want to try to tease out is I think in some ways it's accurate that the land grabs of public lands, or when we talk about these takeovers of public lands, that individuals or small, you know, we're often not talking about somebody who runs four cows or something. We're actually talking about, you know, the largest public lands ranchers in the West are, but I don't know, Anheuser-Busch or just huge corporations. And it's the same with mining, et cetera. So on one level, this public lands takeover, the individual, the rugged rancher, is a Trojan horse. And I would like for you to talk about that. And then at the same time, like you also said, there's 35% or whatever the people in Burns supported it. And in Crescent City, it would be the same. If there was going to be some sort of takeover of the local national park, the many locals would support it, even those who are, you know, small business owners, have nothing and would gain nothing out of it. So can you talk about both of those? Do you see what I'm trying to get at? There's
sure,
this Trojan horse element,
and
at the same time, there is this support for the Trojan horse, there's also the individual, anyway, if you know what I'm trying to ask, then you can do a better job of answering it than I did of asking it.
The point that you're trying to make, which is accurate, is that there's a populist front of the, quote, little man or woman put out in, to represent the efforts to privatize these lands or to, at the very least, reduce regulations on how they are used and utilized. And you're absolutely correct. For example, J.R. Simplot, a billionaire in Idaho who's now dead, but his corporation still exists, was, and he may still be, the single largest permittee on public lands. and I think number two and three are several mining companies in Nevada, which gets to your point that, you know, one J.R. Simplot controls more public grazing land than, you know, 1,000 small-time ranchers that are out there. And yet the face that will be is the guy who's got 100 cows or something, you know, and got torn up jeans in an old pickup truck, and we don't see the corporate J.R. Simplot represented in any attempts to talk about how there should be more grazing on public lands. And the same thing is true for logging and so forth. But, you know, big corporations, Weyerhaeuser, Plum Creek, you know, these are names that we all know, are who dominate logging on public lands. And ironically, just like grazing on public lands, most timber sales on public lands, if not all, are subsidized by taxpayers. And so we're indirectly subsidizing these corporations and their stockholders. And we, of course, have the same thing with mining on public lands and oil and gas drilling. Almost all the demand for utilizing public lands and for trying to get them with fewer regulations and under state control in particular is that states tend to be more manipulable, I don't know if that's the right word, malleable maybe, more receptive to reducing regulations than even the federal government, which is not great, but has more backbone than most state governments do. So the idea is that if we put these lands under state control, we'll be able to log more, we'll be able to graze easier, et cetera. And the and that's all fronted by this, you know, populist face of a poor logger or a poor rancher, when in fact the beneficiaries will largely be corporations and very wealthy individuals who can control large segments of that particular industry.
And that's all true, and that's half of it, but there's also, how does it, okay, you and I both understand this, and we are veterans of fighting against those corporations. But that doesn't alter the fact that you get, decades ago now, I was at a Forest Service meet and greet, and I got into a hour-long argument with some guy about clear-cutting, and the guy was the owner of a drive-in. I mean, he didn't have a vested interest. He wasn't a Palm Creek Flack. And there is still this, like you just said, there's this 30% support for, how does it end up happening that there is this populist support for these corporate land grabs? That's really what I'm getting at too.
Well, part of it is a failure, as I was mentioning earlier, looking at their past economies, a failure to understand where they are and to even imagine where they're going. A lot of that sense is, oh, if we only could reopen the mill here, we'd have a nice economy again. Not that, you know, of course, never really looking at the fact that even the people that worked in the mills or the loggers in the woods generally, on the face of it, didn't really like their jobs that much anyway. But I guess, you know, the point being is that They identify with the larger corporations and the rich landowners because they see those folks as representing similar values, even though they are not likely to benefit from those changes. And some of it's philosophical. It's to make an analogy to the current situation with the Republican attempt to revisit health care. At least what's been produced so far would harm a lot of the poor rural residents of the West. And yet, overwhelmingly, those same residents are supporting the Republican agenda, even though it will hurt them. And that's not an uncommon thing. People, you know, one of the free marketeer type people, like the Peer and Bozeman, PER, I don't know what it stands for anymore, but something economic research. But they are free market proponents, And they always argue, assuming that people are rational about economics, but they're not. A lot of people do not vote in their own economic self-interest, partly because sometimes they don't even realize what would be in their economic self-interest, or they have other philosophical components to why they support a certain agenda. And so, the fundamental assumptions that local people know the land better, they're going to take care of it better, those are all slogans that you hear, but they are not borne out by actual experience. And when we see how, you have to go back to why did these lands get taken out of sort of the giveaway in the first place? They got taken out of the giveaway and to remain as federal lands because they were largely being abused. I mean, the reason or the rationale for creation of the Forest Service, for example, was to control the excessive logging that was occurring on lands and to protect watersheds. The reason we had the BLM created was to correct the abusive grazing that was happening. And to a degree, all these agencies, for all their flaws and faults, have done a better job of that than not having the regulations. They've done a better job than what happens on private lands. The worst clear cuts you see in Oregon are all on private lands. The worst grazing lands in the West are generally private. When you compare land that are equal kind of vegetation, despite what I can tell you about how badly the BLM manages grazing, it still does a better job than what happens on private land. So the assumption that if you put it in private hands, it would be taken care of better is not borne out by the actual experience. You can always find exceptions, of course, but in general, private lands are more abused than public lands.
So we have about 7 or 8 minutes left, and one of the reasons I love talking with you is because we get this bigger picture and this has been a wonderful history lesson. And I'm wondering if you can bring us up to date and talk, once again, we only have 7 or 8 minutes, if you can talk about the most recent round of attempts at land grabbing, perhaps start with Reagan and then bring us up to Trump. And talk about the political movement to take over or destroy or assault public lands.
Well, there are two ways to talk about takeover, and you don't have to necessarily have a change in ownership as much as change in policy. So, like talking about Reagan and other presidents, a lot of particularly the Republican presidents that we've had have appointed people like James Watt was Reagan's Secretary of Interior, who are very hostile to the very idea of public lands, protecting endangered species, and so forth. So by appointing people who in many cases worked for industry prior to their appointment, and we saw that with the Bush administration too, who had former executives from timber industries running the Forest Service, things like that, we get a top-down command that can greatly affect the policies on the ground. Now, still ultimately, as long as we retain the ownership, we can correct those over time. But one of the ways that you sort of work the system is you don't actually work to get it under some other ownership. You just work to invalidate regulations and put in more friendly administrators and regulations. And that's what we see happening under the Trump administration right now. I mean, things like the EPA took down any mention of climate change on its website. We have, Secretary of Interior Zinke looking at 27 national monuments to see if they should be eliminated or resized. These are all efforts to reduce the sort of, you might say, long-term sustainability and integrity of these public lands and to give more control to those people who are seen as, you know, deserving of their use. And that brings up another topic. That's one of my things that I've worked about with the media, you know, constantly. They talk about local control as if, again, using Burns as an example, just because you live in Burns, Oregon, you have some sort of right to express and exert greater manipulation, express greater control and authority over what is federal domain owned by all Americans, who are, by the way, also paying the bill for these lands. And to my mind, you know, there is already an exorbitant amount of local control. And that's another reason that if you're living in Burns, Oregon, you can walk into the, you know, BLM office or the district ranger's office there and have a discussion with the administration there, the district ranger, the BLM manager, and voice your opinion. And, of course, even if you do it nicely, those people know it. And there's a it's very hard to be like a BLM manager or Forest Service district ranger living in a town like Burns, because you know you want to get along, you want your kids to be in, you know, enjoy the schools and so forth. So you have a strong incentive to try to work with that local rancher, logger, whomever, to satisfy them and make them happy. Even if it's to the detriment of the long-term public interest. And so we have that kind of call for more local control, which just seems crazy to me, given that there's already an exorbitant amount of local control and influence already occurring.
So what do you want people to do with this information, and what do you want them to do, especially regarding the assault on public lands?
Well, two or three things. The most immediate thing right now is to encourage people to make comments in support of the existing national monuments, which the Secretary of Interior is taking comment on right now for the next couple of months. And the Bears here in Utah, it's got a comment there, it's going to end May 25th, so pretty soon. But the others have a few, I think, another month beyond that. So try to write comments saying, hey, I want these lands protected and remain as national monuments. And then beyond that, to realize that there's a constant assault. And, you know, you'll hear all this rhetoric about how it's destroying the economy, which is false. You hear the rhetoric that locals know best how to manage, which is false. You'll hear that the best way to utilize these lands is for some sort of resource extraction, which invariably taxpayers support. We subsidize the logging, we subsidize the grazing, et cetera. That's just the straight subsidies. And if you look at the environmental costs of those activities, in other words, when you log a hillside and you get erosion or the grazing affects the pollutes the water or spreads weeds, the rest of us pay for fixing those problems, if we fix them at all. And so the cost of having these activities occur is huge. So we're subsidizing the destruction of these lands. And that's an important point to remember. And so the more of those activities that occur, or the less regulation of those activities, the more it costs us all in the future.
Well, thank you so much, and I would like to thank listeners for listening. My guest today has been George Werthner. This is Derek Jensen for Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network.